Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm really going out on a limb here. We just heard a delightful talk on wonder and awe. Now it's the middle of the afternoon on a Saturday. It's the last talk of the conference, and I'm talking about boredom. So the stakes are high. I'm sure the name Timothy Radcliffe is a familiar name to many of you. Father Radcliffe was previously the master of the Order of Preachers. Those of you who have read his book, Why Go to Church, may remember that it opens with the following anecdote. One Sunday, a mother shook her son awake, telling him it was time to go to church. No effect. 10 minutes later, she was back. Get out of bed immediately and go to church. Mother, I don't want to. It's so boring. Why should I bother? For two reasons. You know you must go to church on a Sunday. And secondly, you are the bishop of the diocese. You're laughing, and thank you for laughing, because my notes, it says you're laughing because, so I'm glad that you actually laugh. You're laughing because you weren't expecting him to be a bishop. Why not? Well, because a bishop is the last person you'd think would be bored by the idea of going to church, or at least the last person you can imagine admitting to it. Most Christians would feel at least mildly ashamed to admit that they find church boring, but there's something wildly inappropriate about a bishop expressing this feeling. A bishop is a living symbol of the unity of the church. If he's bored, then what hope is there for the rest of us? So this will be the focus of my talk this afternoon, not about bishops or about going to church, but simply about boredom itself. More specifically, I want to help us think about the moral dimensions of boredom and why we think, or at least why we ought to think, that boredom is not a morally appropriate response to certain situations. We can imagine a young child who, upon seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time, whines, "This is boring," and asks if he can have his iPad instead. We only wonder what has gone wrong in this child's moral formation that could have produced such a response to one of the most breathtaking sights in the natural world. But the tricky thing about boredom is the same thing that's tricky about all of the emotions or passions. Namely, that we have very little control over them as we are experiencing them. As the name suggests, passions are something we experience, something that happens to us, not something we do. So we need to be sure that we have a good grasp of the relationship between the passions and moral agency, which is something we've been, of course, exploring the past day and a half. Now, St. Thomas Aquinas gives us a very good set of tools for working out this relationship. But there's one glaring problem right off the bat. It's that there doesn't seem to be any discussion of boredom in Thomas's treatise on the passions in the Summa Theologiae, nor anywhere else in his writings. Some contemporary authors have tried to bring Thomas into contemporary conversations about boredom by translating what he says about related concepts like sloth or despair, acedia or desperatio. But there are significant problems with this approach. One is that there is a wide gulf between these two concepts, between these concepts and the contemporary concept of boredom. Many scholars have attempted to trace the conceptual evolution of boredom back to the first centuries of Christianity, where the problem arose within monasticism. On some accounts, an excess of contemplation was the main reason that medieval monks suffered from boredom. It's the kind of boredom resulting from the satiety of having to spend all of one's time doing the same religious task over and over. It was understood to be a cardinal sin and condemned by Christian morality for representing a deviation from devoting one's time to contemplation. This is identified as the sin of sloth, acedia, or chadia, in the monastic tradition, and it was analyzed in great detail by writers like Evagrius, the 4th century monk. But as the idea developed, it took on a slightly different character. Some scholars have even tried to identify specific characterizations of boredom with specific centuries. For example, one scholar writes, in the 11th century, leisure and drowsiness are highlighted. In the 12th century, the protagonist is lack of fervor. And in the 13th century, acedia is understood as internalized or depressive sadness, and so on. Now, not everyone tries to be this precise, but there does seem to be a consensus that the concept of acedia evolved into a psychological concept by the Middle Ages, where it was understood in relation to affective states like depression and sadness. Moving into the Renaissance period, there was an even greater emphasis on its bodily aspects and less emphasis on its spiritual or moral dimensions, and it developed into the concept of melancholy. We might describe this as a kind of secularized version of acedia. Melancholy is the precursor to our modern concept of boredom, which draws upon features of all these earlier concepts, but it also has a much stronger existential component. On the other hand, some scholars of boredom argue, and this is in fact the dominant view in the literature, that boredom was only invented in the 18th century and didn't really take off until the 20th century. In recent years, the literature has focused on the role of social and cultural conditions in the way we understand boredom. And that's basically where we are today. Now, one may certainly challenge the narrative that I've just described, but it means that anyone who wants to jump into the current intellectual discourse about boredom by invoking Thomas Aquinas is going to have a lot of explaining to do. So that's one challenge. The other challenge is one that I actually take more seriously. It's the observation that boredom, as it's understood today, is typically meant to describe a feeling, an experience, or a condition. But in the Christian tradition, including the writings of St. Thomas, achadia is identified as a sin. It's not just a feeling or a condition, it's a vice. It's a habit, a conditioned response to our environment, and as such, it's something for which we are morally culpable. Now, even on this description, we might want to say that there can still be a great deal of overlap between the two concepts. I think there is. But we can't simply treat them synonymously without making some serious mistakes. And I want to avoid those mistakes, so I'm going to take some time to clarify what boredom means in our contemporary context and how Thomas's understanding of the passions can help us think more clearly about it. There's a real need for this kind of project because very few scholars are engaging the moral dimensions of boredom, whether they're Thomists or not. There's a massive body of contemporary literature on boredom, and ironically, a lot of it is very boring. But more importantly, most of this literature is going to be of little help if we want to know where boredom and our response to boredom fits into the moral life. Kevin Gary, in his recent book, Why Boredom Matters, explains, researchers continue to refine and sharpen our diagnosis of the problem, but remain neutral on how best to contend with it. Boredom signals a misalignment of our desires with our environment, but with regard to the question of alignment, or how best to contend with boredom, we are on our own. Now, I'm a moral theologian, so I can't help but think about boredom from a normative perspective. That's just what I do. Now, in case anyone is holding their breath, I'm not going to offer a cure for boredom or suggest 5 practical steps for avoiding boredom or anything like that. But I am going to give an account, with the help of Thomas Aquinas, of how a person with well-integrated passions will respond to the experience and conditions of boredom. I should note that Kevin Gary's book, the one I just quoted, also offers an antidote to boredom, but he's much more interested in the cultural aspects of boredom, especially in the context of education and pedagogy, and how we might reform our social structures and cultural practices. So we're looking at this problem from different, but I think complementary perspectives. So this will be an examination of boredom through the lens of Thomistic moral theology. So in good Thomistic fashion, I'm going to begin with a definition of boredom and then introduce some distinctions. I'm not going to try to be creative in giving a definition of boredom. There are dozens of definitions on offer in the scholarly literature, but I think this one is as good as any. It's by Peter Tui, a classicist. He says, boredom is an emotion which produces feelings of being constrained or confined by some unavoidable and distastefully predictable circumstance, and as a result, a feeling of being distant from one's surroundings and the normal flow of time. If you think that that definition is maybe a bit too wordy, you're not alone, because Tui himself says, but that is a very cumbersome definition. One of the tests for a good definition is that it's easy to remember. So he says, let's try again. He says, boredom is a social emotion of mild disgust produced by a temporarily unavoidable and predictable circumstance. So that will be our working definition for now. While we're thinking about this definition, there's another important observation to be made about boredom. It's this. It's that boredom, by definition, is an emotion that is inherently unpleasant. It's impossible to find joy while feeling bored. Now, this may strike some of you as obvious and trivial. It may strike others of you as simply false. So let me respond to each of those reactions. So if you think it's obvious that boredom is not an emotion that someone can find pleasurable, well, I think we should at least note that it's not obvious simply because it's an unpleasant emotion. That's not the reason. Because there are many emotions or feelings which are typically unpleasant that some people in some circumstances find pleasurable. So many people find it enjoyable to experience physical pain. They may get a thrill out of it. Sadness also can be pleasurable in its own way. This has been observed at least since the time of the ancient Greeks, who wrote about catharsis and why it feels nice to have a good cry every once in a while. But boredom cannot be described in this way. It's unpleasant for everyone, everywhere, all the time. This leads me to respond to the second reaction. So if you think that it's false, that is, if you think that boredom can be enjoyable, then you're simply misunderstanding what we mean by boredom. Because boredom is, by definition, an inability to find enjoyment in one's activity. Now, I'll admit that there have been times in my life when I've been envious of people who claim that they are bored. I think to myself, well, lucky for you. I have too much work to even think about being bored. I would give anything to be bored right now. But of course, all I really mean is that I'm envious of their circumstances. What I'm saying is, if my time were my own and I had an open horizon of opportunity before me, well, I would have no trouble finding something enjoyable to do. In fact, I would enjoy doing nothing at all. The fact that I would enjoy being in that state, however, means precisely that I would not be bored. Boredom is an inherently unpleasant emotion, and all of us, no matter who we are, seek to avoid it. So, for our purposes, when we're talking about boredom, we're referring to an emotion of mild disgust produced by a temporarily unavoidable and predictable circumstance. So it's an emotion that we seek to avoid. This idea of boredom can become rather nuanced when we consider its many variations and possibilities. So I'm going to highlight a few of the distinctions that appear in the vast body of scholarly literature. So first, there's a distinction between what's referred to as subjective and objective boredom, or more precisely, objective and subjective dimensions of boredom. The idea here is that there are some situations that are generally recognized to be objectively boring. It's the proverbial scenario of watching paint dry. These are situations that pretty much no one finds enjoyable, but most of us find ourselves in from time to time. So standing in a long checkout line, or sitting in a waiting room at a dentist's office are some everyday examples. What's important about the category of objective boredom is that it recognizes that there are circumstances in which, even if we do not want to say that it's good to be bored, it's at least perfectly understandable and normal for someone to experience boredom. So from the standpoint of behavioral psychology, there's nothing abnormal about feeling bored in these situations. Subjective boredom refers to any situation that I personally find boring. I mean, any of us, not just me. This can vary widely from person to person. It can depend on a person's mental state, personal taste, and a number of other factors. Our perception of what is boring changes as we go through life. Many activities require specialized knowledge or acquired taste in order to find them interesting and not boring. For example, you could put me in the audience of a lecture on nuclear physics, and it could be the most brilliant lecture on nuclear physics given by anyone in the 21st century, and I would most likely be very bored. But this does not require me to make a judgment that the lecture is boring. I may be able to recognize by the enthusiastic responses of everyone else in the audience that I am the odd man out. I can recognize that I am bored even if the lecture itself is not boring. I'm simply acknowledging that I do not have the requisite background knowledge to be excited and engaged by this lecture. It's not always this straightforward, of course. Sometimes we argue and debate about what is objectively boring. We do it all the time. Say you go to an art house theater with a friend to watch a screening of Fellini's film 8½. Walking out of the theater, you say that you loved it, but your friend declares that it was pretentious, self-indulgent, and yes, boring. And you say, what? You don't understand. Maybe you just need to know more about Fellini's life and about the history of Italian cinema. And your friend says, I don't care what anyone says. That was a snooze fest, and nothing you could tell me is ever going to change my opinion about it. So even if you never come to an agreement with your friend, it's at least clear that what you're arguing about is something in the nature of the film itself that is boring or boredom-inducing. That's the idea behind objective boredom. By the way, is Father Raymond Snyder in the crowd? Okay. So if you're bored, I encourage you sometime, or if you're not, just for fun, look up an article that he wrote called Whether St. Thomas is Boring. It's written in the disputatio style of the Summa. It has objections, sed contra, and everything else. So the respondeo begins this way. A thing may be called boring in two ways, in itself, per se, or accidentally, per accidens, on account of some accompanying factor. Thomas, considered in himself, is not boring. And it goes, you'll have to read the rest yourself. It's a very nice example, actually, of this distinction between subjective and objective boredom. All right, another distinction we find in the literature is a distinction between state boredom and trait boredom. The difference here is between the subjective experience of boredom and its frequency of occurrence with the predisposition to be easily bored. In other words, it's one thing to find yourself bored sometimes, we all do. It's another to have a predisposition to boredom, especially in situations that are not considered to be objectively boring. Psychologists are especially interested in trait boredom because it's associated with various problematic behaviors and mental health issues. Trait boredom can be measured and quantified. You can take a test called the Boredom Proneness Scale. Doesn't that sound fun? It asks you to provide numerical responses to statements like this. Time always seems to be passing slowly. I often wake up with a new idea. It takes more stimulation to get me going than most people. On and on. You rate these 1 to 7 and you get a score. Much of the research happening in boredom studies right now focus on the relationship between these two types of boredom. Researchers are interested in the causal relationship between the two, and they're interested in exploring why, for example, people who report high levels of state boredom do not necessarily have high levels of trait boredom. It's an interesting question. The next distinction is one that I've constructed. Now, it's quite possible that I have simply missed something in the literature, but as far as I can tell, no one has quite captured the distinction that I have in mind, so this is my small contribution to the discussion. It's the distinction between what I call placid boredom and tedious boredom. By placid boredom, I mean boredom that occurs in a setting where there is a possibility of either engaging in some other activity or engaging in contemplation while performing an activity. So if I'm literally sitting around doing nothing and yet I feel bored, but the only thing stopping me from pursuing some other activity is the fact that I don't feel like it because every other activity I can imagine doing strikes me as equally boring, well, then this is placid boredom. But it also describes other scenarios in which I might already be engaged in an activity. For example, many household chores we consider boring still at least allow for the possibility of reflection and contemplation. So folding the laundry, doing dishes, mowing the lawn, these are all activities that most people find that they don't find very stimulating or meaningful in themselves, but at least it's possible to engage in some amount of reflection and mental stimulation while doing them. This can be very practical. For example, you might start crafting that email in your head that you need to send to your boss. It can be more noble and spiritual, for example, bringing your needs before God in prayer. And at times, we may feel too tired or too bored by the outward activity itself to engage in such reflection, but we can still acknowledge its possibility. So all of that falls under what I'm calling placid boredom. But contrast this with what I call tedious boredom. Tedious boredom arises from activities that require just enough focus such that contemplation or reflection are not possible. What do I mean? Well, imagine working on a dangerous assembly line in a factory for long hours. You can't let your mind wander, or you'll be putting your limbs or your life at risk. Or to take a less extreme example, and probably one more familiar to people in this room, grading papers. Maybe you teach a large undergraduate philosophy course and you're reading your 37th student essay on Plato's Allegory of the Cave. It's repetitive, but it's not like folding laundry. You actually have to pay attention to what you're doing. You can't meditate on the great mysteries of the faith while you're grading a giant stack of student essays. Now, I'm aware that this is being recorded, and I just want to say that if any of my students are listening to this right now, their essays are always brilliant and insightful. Not boring at all. Okay, finally, there is a distinction between what's called situational boredom and existential boredom. You see this everywhere in the literature. It's often attributed to Heidegger. The basic idea here, as the term suggests, is that situational boredom is an emotion that is experienced in isolated instances, whereas existential boredom describes a mode of existence. Existential boredom is a sort of ennui, a restlessness about the meaning and purpose of life. Of course, this can overlap to a great extent with clinical depression, but it's not synonymous. Many philosophers recognize existential boredom as a discrete phenomenon. Sylvia Plath describes it through the observation of her character Esther Greenwood, the protagonist of her novel The Bell Jar. Esther meets some girls of whom she later writes, "These girls looked awfully bored to me. I saw them on the sunroof yawning and painting their nails and trying to keep up their Bermuda tans, and they seemed bored as hell. I talked with one of them, and she was bored with yachts and bored with flying around in airplanes and bored with skiing in Switzerland at Christmas and bored with the men in Brazil." Existential boredom doesn't have to look like crippling depression. It can also look like someone who is simply bored with life. So our next task is to consider how these many layers of boredom might be understood and analyzed from the perspective of Thomistic moral theology. First, let's investigate a potential synonym for boredom that can be found in Thomas's writings. It's a term that clearly has some relationship with boredom, which is why I used it in the title of my talk. It's the Latin word tedium. Now, depending on context, it can be translated in many ways into English: boredom, weariness, loathing, sadness, tedium, and actually a lot more. It's quite a range of meaning. Now, Thomas uses this word many times in his writings, but he does not use it univocally. He frequently quotes, I found at least 8 instances of this, he quotes the Book of Wisdom, chapter 8, verse 16, which contains the phrase, "Life with her," that is wisdom, "has no tedium, but gladness and joy." Now, in most contemporary translations of this verse, tedium is translated as pain. So something like, "there is no pain with her." I rather like Richard Regan's translation, though, which reads, "no conversation or company with her is boring." The idea is that whatever tedium is, wisdom is an antidote to it. Now, unfortunately, the many different meanings of this term, several of which do not overlap with boredom at all, disqualifies it as a potential synonym. For example, in the Tertia Pars, Thomas articulates the many ways in which Christ suffered during his life. He writes that Christ suffered in his soul from sadness, tedium, and fear. I'm fairly confident that Thomas doesn't mean to say here that Christ suffered from boredom. So, tedium is best translated probably as weariness in this context. So if that's not the route we can take, let's see if we can find anything in his treatment of the passions that closely maps onto the foregoing analysis of boredom. Actually, if you have the chart from Professor Jensen's talk earlier, I'm serious, it would be handy to have this in front of you. If you get bored while you're listening to me, what you can do is you can play a little game and ask yourself, where would boredom fit on this chart? Most scholars today classify boredom as an emotion. So the question is, would Thomas recognize boredom as a passion of the soul? Let's think about where it might fit into his schema. So for Thomas, the principal passions of the soul are joy, sadness, hope, and fear. These can be expanded, as we've seen, into a slightly longer list of 11 passions. But among these, there are two that appear to be promising prospects for aligning with the concept of boredom, sadness and despair, tristitia and desperatio. Now, sadness is too broad to be synonymous with boredom, but it begins to look more promising when we dig deeper into what Thomas says about it, because he identifies four different species of sadness. And I just list, just for simplicity's sake, I just included the one that I thought was relevant, and it's achaia. Now, I know I put sloth in there, and it's the thing is, whenever the vice of achaia is translated, it's usually sloth. But I try to stick with the Latin just to help us not get too confused, because right now we're talking about the passion, which is distinct from the vice. And in fact, some English translations, they kind of cheat. It's the same Latin word, but they'll use like torpor or something like that to make the point that it's different than the vice. But it's achaia. All right, so things look even more promising when we recall that these are passions. They're not the same as the sins or vices that may happen to share the same name. Several of the passions share names with virtues and vices. Just name just a few: hatred, concupiscence, hope, despair, anger. There's some crossover there. But we have to be careful, because the passions of the soul are, for the most part, morally neutral, and with some qualification, of course. The moral goodness or badness of the passion depends on its object. It's good to be angry about certain things. It's bad to be angry about others. But the passion of anger is neither good nor bad in its species. And thanks to Professor Hertz's talk earlier this morning, we have a much richer understanding of that. Okay, so far so good. At the moment, despair and sloth are on the table as potential passions that may bear an equivalence to boredom. These passions are not in themselves sinful. Let's make sure we understand why these two passions, whose terms have a negative connotation, might be a good and appropriate response in some situations. So despair, simply put, is a response to an arduous or a difficult good. It's the opposite of hope. So when you want something, but you come to the conclusion that it's not possible to obtain that thing, or that it's simply too much effort, you experience the passion of despair. Remember, it's not the same thing as the sin of despair. Thomas describes the sin of despair as a failure to believe God's promises. It is to call God a liar. He says that it is the most grievous among mortal sins. While we're thinking about this kind of despair, a kind of spiritual despair, it's helpful to point out that even this is not an expression of boredom. It's rather an attempt to mitigate boredom. I think this is really beautifully illustrated by the poet Christian Wiman in his memoir, My Bright Abyss. He says this: "Religious despair is often a defense against boredom and the daily grind of existence. Lacking intensity in our lives, we say that we are distant from God and then seek to make that distance into an intense experience. It is among the most difficult spiritual ailments to heal because it is usually wholly illusory. There are definitely times when we must suffer God's absence, when we are called to enter the dark night of the soul in order to pass into some new understanding of God, some deeper communion with him and with all creation. But this is very rare, and for the most part, our dark nights of the soul are, in a way that is more pathetic than tragic, wishful thinking." That hits pretty hard. But that is the sin of despair. That is a spiritual despair. The passion of despair, however, is much less interesting. It could simply be a result of giving up on some otherwise worthwhile task. So, for example, some mornings I aspire to go on a bike ride before I start my day. So the night before, I'll set my alarm, I'll set up my cycling gear, I'll make a plan. But it doesn't always work out. Sometimes I have four kids, and sometimes my kids need help with something. Sometimes I'll remember all of a sudden an email that I was supposed to send the day before. And I realize as I'm watching the clock tick away that the bike ride is probably not going to happen. So I feel despair. Even though I'm choosing to do one of those other things, it's my choice, choosing to do that instead of the bike ride, there's still a sense of loss. Obviously, this is a very relatively mild form of despair, but it's a good reminder that it can be a fairly mundane passion. I hope, though, that you can see the problem here, because what I've just been describing has virtually nothing to do with boredom. While we might be able to think of some examples of despair, this kind of despair that I've been describing, as they overlap with boredom, it's clear that they're nowhere near synonymous. Okay, so what about the passion of acedia? Well, again, we need to make a distinction. We're not talking about the sin. We're talking about the passion, which Thomas describes as an oppressive sorrow. That's the vice, is an oppressive sorrow. Thomas describes the passion of acedia as a kind of stasis, an inability to move. He says that the mind becomes weighed down so much that the limbs become motionless. Now, this almost sounds like boredom. The problem is he thinks that this stasis results from anxiety or a sense that escape from one's condition seems impossible. And the way he describes it suggests very extreme situations that lead to a state of literal motionlessness. So it's too severe to capture many of the instances of garden variety boredom. And it's too severe, and it's also too narrow because it doesn't align with existential boredom. There are a lot of people who are existentially bored who are able to at least go through the motions of life, but it's just the problem is that they're not finding satisfaction in it, but they're not like literally, frozen. So where does this leave us? Well, there are a few possibilities. One is that boredom is a genuinely modern concept that simply isn't considered by pre-modern thinkers like Thomas. I think this is wrong. One good argument against this possibility is that the modern concept of boredom isn't really a coherent concept at all. That's my take. Or put another way, if we want to say that boredom is an emotion, then we, and by we I mean academics, have made the mistake of trying to fit too much into the meaning of the term boredom. It simply can't bear the weight of all of these distinctions that we've noted in our analysis. Subjective versus objective boredom, state versus trait boredom, placid versus tedious boredom, structural versus existential boredom. I think I just got bored reading that list. Now, Peter Tui, who I quoted earlier, at least partially agrees with me on this. He, regarding the supposed distinction between situational and existential boredom, he says, the only definition to fully cover it runs as follows. Existential boredom entails a powerful and unrelieved sense of emptiness, isolation, and disgust in which the individual feels a persistent lack of interest in and difficulty with concentrating on his current circumstances. And then he goes on to say, I wonder if the simplest way to understand existential boredom is not this. It is a concept. It's not an emotion, and it's not a feeling. It's a concept that is constructed from a union of boredom, chronic boredom, depression, a sense of superfluity, frustration, surfeit, disgust, indifference, apathy, and feelings of entrapment. I think that's right. I think that this critique can even be extended to the entire concept, and I'm using that word concept very deliberately here, the concept of boredom as we've come to understand it. So the reason that we have such trouble finding historic antecedents for the term is because it's something that we've manufactured out of a variety of experiences and emotions that have been familiar to human beings throughout human history. So if I'm right about that, then where does that leave us? What's the other possibility? Well, the good news is that Thomistic moral theology has much to say about boredom. It simply means that we need to use more precision and break down the various layers and shades of meaning of boredom before we can be clear about what we're talking about. And in fact, that's what we've been doing, so that wasn't just a waste of time. We've already begun that exercise. Now, there's a lot more that needs to be said, of course, but what I've been trying to do is to demonstrate what I think is the right approach. So the passions of sorrow, despair, and acedia are certainly relevant to this conversation, but we have to do quite a bit of work before we can begin to answer questions such as, how should we respond to boredom? Or how can we avoid boredom? I will admit, when I first began working on this topic, I thought that I was going to approach it by asking and attempting to answer the question, is it always a sin to be bored? But the deeper that I got into the literature on boredom, and the more I consulted Thomas's writings on the passions, I came to the conclusion that this is a deeply confused question. We need to be much more precise about what we are actually asking. So before I conclude, I have one more task that I want to accomplish in this talk. I noted that there's still much more to be said about boredom and the morality of the passions. For the record, I do think that in many, if not most, instances, it probably is a sin to be bored. The Christian moral tradition is pretty consistent on this point, and I take no exception to it. But I want to say something specifically about a person whose passions are fully integrated, and how this integration leads such a person to avoid morally culpable instances of boredom. It's often assumed, based on my survey of contemporary Christian literature on this topic, that the proper Christian response to boredom is to cultivate some particular set of virtues or character traits, and these often include joy, wonder, awe, and gratitude, and so on. And I appreciated Professor Elliott's point earlier, as much as he emphasized the role of wonder and awe in the moral life, it's not everything, right? We need the full picture, and I completely agree with that. So these are all very important, of course, but the one passion or emotion that I never see mentioned in this conversation, at least when we're talking about an antidote to boredom, is sorrow. Now, I've just gone out of my way to suggest that boredom is a confused concept, and while that is true, I think, we can also note that one feature that many versions of boredom have in common is sadness. This is true from the most mild situational boredom to the most extreme varieties of existential boredom. Oftentimes, the sadness that arises from the various emotions that we refer to as boredom are an inappropriate or misplaced sadness. And we can see why many Christians would be inclined to say that joy is the antidote to sadness. I mean, that answer even sounds Thomistic, right? Because joy and sadness are the most fundamental passions, according to Thomas. If you want to boil it down to two, he says those are the most fundamental, joy and sadness, and they're binaries. They both reside in the concupiscible appetite. Perhaps surprisingly, though, the antidote to disordered sadness is not necessarily joy or just joy. Joy is only part of the picture. The other essential component to rightly integrated passions is sorrow. If we recall that the passions are not good and evil in themselves, then this means that it is appropriate to feel sorrow for some things. The classic example that Thomas gives is a person mourning for his sins. Importantly, he also explains that proper sorrow is perfectly compatible with happiness and joy. You can feel two contrary passions at the same time, provided that those passions are directed toward different objects. He explains, for example, that if we see a good person suffering, we rejoice at their goodness, at the same time grieve for their suffering. Another overlooked text in this discussion is the Beatitude, "Blessed are those who mourn," given by our Lord in the Sermon on the Mount. In his commentary on this passage, Thomas Aquinas describes this mourning as lament. It expresses itself in mourning for our own sins, as well as the sins of others, and mourning for dwelling in this present misery. This is the way that the passion of sorrow works. It can even extend to evils of the past, present, and future. And well-formed and well-integrated sorrow cannot help but be attentive to our own sins and the sins of the world. Rowan Williams, in his recent book on the passions of the soul, makes a similar connection between this beatitude and the passion of sorrow. He writes, "Listen to that strange blessing for those who mourn. Don't be afraid to acknowledge that this hurts. Don't be afraid of acknowledging that the world itself hurts. The worst thing that can happen to you is a kind of anesthesia of spirit, somehow not noticing your own hurt or the hurt of others. It doesn't mean that you'll be submerged in that hurt. You will only learn not to be trapped in suffering when you acknowledge its reality and look for its sources. It's a kind of honest grappling with the world, the way the world is compared to how it ought to be. The main point here, and this is what makes this a theological claim rather than merely a philosophical claim, is that this sorrow is not only compatible with the passion of joy, it's constitutive of it. And this can only come about through faith in God's promises that sin does not, in fact, have the last word. Another theologian who gets this exactly right is John Calvin. Now, I know this is a Thomistic Circles conference, but bear with me. Just listen to what Calvin says. He says, "Now, nothing is supposed to be more inconsistent with happiness than mourning. But Christ does not merely affirm that mourners are not unhappy. He shows that their very mourning contributes to a happy life by preparing them to receive eternal joy and by furnishing them with excitements to seek true comfort in God alone." I think Thomas Aquinas would heartily approve. It's not just that their mourning is morally appropriate as a response to the sadness of the world. Their mourning contributes to a happy life because it leads them to seek true comfort in God alone. So I'll conclude with an illustration from one person's life who exemplified this holy mixture of joy and sadness. That person is Saint Dominic. Many of Dominic's contemporaries and his biographers testify that his ministry was driven by an intense desire to see people saved from their own sins. He was known to pray, "O Lord, have mercy on thy people. What is to become of sinners?" He was often found weeping in his cell while he was praying. While he was moved to pray for those who were afflicted by their own sins and the sins of others, he was also known to weep at the altar while reciting the canon of the Mass because he was so overcome by the intensity of the drama of salvation. Dominic's tears were central to his spirituality. But as St. Thomas would remind us, these tears were an expression of rightly ordered and purified passions. So I think that Thomas would tell us that the remedy for boredom is not simply joy or awe or gratitude or some combination of these. He would recognize that what we call boredom is a state of sadness, a kind of sadness, but it's often a disordered sadness. So we may find ourselves bored to tears, but Thomas would encourage us to move from boredom to tears. That is, the tears of holy sadness. In other words, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, and neither shall they be bored. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.